a theme that I had intended but failed to actually address the last couple of times I was with you, which is the doctrine of divine eternity. We've looked, if not that you have to remember, it's been, I know you get me with big gaps in between, but that's all right. The last two times we were together in Sunday school, we looked at God's omnipresence, and I wanted to consider then, in addition to that, God's eternality. And I think on one level, this is a doctrine that is relatively undisputed. Christians believe that we worship the eternal God, the God who is blessed forever, as Romans 9:5 says. So that to call God eternal is not a particularly sectarian or uniquely reformed view of anything. It is I like to call it sort of a standard piece of Christian orthodoxy to confess that God is eternal. In fact, in our, and I'm looking for a hymnal, in our confession, chapter 2, paragraph 1, I'm trying to find the exact page for you, page 671. I'll just read again the first half of the first article. The Lord our God is but one only living and true God, whose subsistence is in and of himself, infinite in being and perfection, whose essence cannot be comprehended by any but himself, a most pure spirit, invisible, without body, parts, or passions, who only hath immortality, dwelling, by the way, there's a slight sort of nod in the direction of eternality, that he's immortal, he's not an extinguishable being. Dwelling in the light, which no man can approach unto, who is immutable, I'll talk about how that's also indispensable to our understanding of his eternality. Immense, and then our doctrine, eternal, incomprehensible, almighty, every way infinite, most holy, most wise, most free, most absolute. And then it goes on to talk about, again, his counsel, the working of his counsel toward us. Maybe a text we can take as a point of departure, and then I'll return to it. Words that are familiar to us. Psalm 90, the first two verses, this is a psalm of a prayer of Moses, says, Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Verse 4 picks up a similar theme about God and time. For 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes, or as a watch in the night. We'll come back to that verse and unpack it in a few moments. Confessing that our God is eternal is standard Christianity, but giving the right sense to eternality, explaining what we mean when we say God is eternal, is becoming increasingly a matter of dispute among Christians. Until maybe 50 years ago, it would have been strange, really exceptional, to find a Christian that believed that eternality simply meant that God was endless. What we meant was, and some of us still mean, was that God was in fact timeless in a strict sense. Not just that he was unendingly passing through time, but rather that he wasn't actually passing through time at all. That eternality did not mean that simply that God always was, but rather that God isn't passing moments, that God's life is not meted out to him the way that ours is, one bit after another. There's no before, there's no after, there's no progression, there's no succession in the life of God. God isn't having experiences. God doesn't have a history, technically speaking. He's not passing through moments. Rather, eternality means somehow exaltation above time, or people would even say outside of time, timeless. That view has begun to be questioned, even within Christendom itself. And I'm not going to rehearse the many people who have questioned it. Well-meaning people that do believe that they are deriving their new understanding from Scripture, that eternality means not that God is beyond time or chronology, but rather that God's chronology, so to speak, simply doesn't have an absolute beginning date or end date, whereas creatures, which have a hope of eternal existence, whether those are the condemned or the righteous in heaven or the angels, have an absolute beginning in time or with time, but we don't have, as it were, an absolute end date, a terminus, an absolute annihilation of our being. Obviously, you don't have eternal life or eternal perdition or the new heavens and the new earth, if that's the case. But the idea is that the only thing that makes us different than God with regard to eternity is that maybe two things. God has more control over the moments of his life, and most will say something like that, and that God's life just simply doesn't have an absolute start time, so to speak. And that's what eternity really means, and that's what the Bible doesn't demand that we regard eternity as meaning anything more than that. And that, in fact, if God is timeless, there are all sorts of strange and impenetrable mysteries that then cloud our understanding of his eternality. Because if God doesn't experience passage of time, then what is the significance of God being with you or near to you at one moment of time in your life and then subsequently at another moment of time in your life? And what is it that God is near to you in one moment and then, you know, as the Old Testament would say, turns away at another? If there's no before and after, if there's no change, if there's no movement, if there's no advancement, then how does the language in which the Bible ordinarily speaks to me of God and his dealings with me even make sense? Timelessness seems to then be a very noble and well-intentioned ancient doctrine that just obviously is in conflict with too much of the Bible's ordinary way of speaking about God. Okay, that is sort of the new evangelical Bible-based opposition to the older notion of eternity as being beyond time or timeless. What I propose to do this week and hopefully next is really probe at some of these assumptions, looking first, what we'll do today is we'll just really get some orientation. I want to run through some traditional Christian definitions of the doctrine and get into a little bit of what do we mean when we call something temporal or when we talk about something being in time. And then I want to then, that'll be about the first half, and then I want to spend the rest of the time looking at some key texts that motivate the traditional doctrine. I want to explain how the classical view, which is certainly the view that's being represented in our confession, understood these texts and why that, in fact, is correct. And then next week, we'll probably get more into some of the contrary voices that are arguing that we have to retool our understanding of eternity. I want to start then with two quotes. One from, and I this is a little maybe out of character for us in a Sunday school class, but one from a Catholic philosopher, the other from a well-known Reformed theologian, Jacques Maritain, Catholic philosopher, says. And by the way, on traditional Catholics on this doctrine. Are right. Okay, so that's why I find some of what they write useful. In fact, I think it's a little more theologically sound than some of the newer evangelical ways of thinking about it. Maritain says, eternity is not a kind of divine time which precedes time. It is a limitless instant which indivisibly embraces the whole succession of time. I told you it was a philosopher, right? So that's going to stretch you a little bit. It's not a different way of being temporal. Okay, maybe I can illustrate this this way, and I'm just going to, let me just take this. My triangle in my illustration is just where I'm going to say that I don't draw pictures of God. I'm not Michelangelo, you know, so I can't do this. But let us call this is the eternal triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And I'm going to draw a line, a solid line underneath this triangle. This line, for my purposes this morning, represents an absolute creator-creature distinction. That is to say, this is the inviolable absolute distinction between God and all that is not God. Okay, creation. Everything creation falls below this line in my illustration. I'm just marking this first line as C. This is the absolute creation or the absolute beginning of the world. And then let's just say this is the created order, and this timeline represents the created order. Not necessarily earthly life. I mean, even heavenly life, actually. Heaven, in this schema, falls where? Yeah, it falls below. It falls on the creation side. So let me illustrate that, and then I'll just say up here, Creator. Good, and we can understand we're talking about the absolute distinction of the Creator and creature. Everything not God, angels, heaven itself, anything created, anything made to be by God falls down here. What Maritain is saying in his statement about time is that while we mark time through the progression, through the measuring of before and after moments here, that God's existence is not a kind of different way of measuring succession or movement along some linear scale. In other words, it's not that we have our kind of time and God has his kind of time. Rather, as he says, divine eternity is not a kind of divine time which precedes time. It is a limitless instant which indivisibly embraces the whole succession of time. So that when we talk about God's life, God takes, as it were, up into his life all that is involved in creation, and he takes it up not successively, the way we experience it, but rather in an indivisible instant of all, from all eternity, so that God is eternally, in this respect, present to the world. Now, immediately questions come in philosophically. Well, if God is eternally present to the world, and God is eternally all that he is, then everything that he is in the world has to be then eternal. So if God is eternally the Redeemer, then redemption has to then be eternalized. If God is eternally the Creator, then creation turns out not to be temporal. It has to be eternalized, etc. What I'm trying to do is avoid this conflation, where when we say something about God, we necessarily then draw the world up into it. Or when we say something about God's dealings with the world, we necessarily drag God's being down into the manner of the world's being. We want to avoid that. Okay, a more theological statement. Maybe this won't help you more, but Herman Bavinck, maybe if you want a great Reformed theology, Herman Bavinck's Reformed Dogmatics. And those of you that don't want to buy the 3,500-page, four-volume thing, because there's life outside of that. There's a great abridgment of it in about 800 pages, and you don't have to read it straight through. You can just treat it as a kind of topical book that you dip into, an intelligent classical statement of the Reformed faith. Bavinck says, "One who says time says motion, change, measurability, computability, limitation, finiteness, creature." I love how he ends. I love how he gets. Basically, time says change, limitation, etc., etc. In effect, time says creation. Time says this is something caused to be. This is something made. In other words, time, properly speaking, is not something that God has or which conditions his life in some respect. All right, a few things then by way of historic definition. I thought I'd start with Boethius in the 6th century, but maybe it'd be better to go back a century and a half to Augustine of Hippo, who writes about time in his famous Confessions. Augustine there says this of God: "Your years do not come and go. Our years pass and new ones arrive, only so that all may come and turn. But your years stand all at once, because they are stable. There is no pushing out of vanishing years by those that are coming on, because with you none are transient." That is to say, they're not coming and going. "Your today does not give way to tomorrow, nor follow yesterday. Your today is eternity." Okay, he says. Something similar, one of my favorite Puritans, John Owen, certainly not the easiest to read, but treasures are there still to be had. Owen confesses that, in fact, God's eternity is, these are my words, a kind of a mind-blowing mystery, but needs to be confessed nonetheless. He says this: "How inconceivable is this glorious divine property unto the thoughts and minds of men! How weak are the ways and terms whereby they go about to express it," including this class, by the way, how weak the terms, okay? That by way of excuse, if this seems difficult. "He that says most only signifies what he knows of what it is not." I love. So the guy who spends 45 minutes in Sunday school talking about it and then spends the next week talking about it only signifies what he knows of what it is not. Okay, that's about right. This is just a big, long, negative exercise in keeping us from temporalizing God. Our eternity is an attempt, is a doctrine by which we attempt from dragging him down into the manner of life that is particular to creatures. Okay. Anyway, we are of yesterday, change every moment, and are leaving our station tomorrow. God is still the same, so before the world was, from eternity. And then I love how Owen concludes this little vignette. He says, "And now I cannot think what I have said, but only have intimated what I adore." The point is not, oh, I totally get eternity. The point is, but I know why I must confess it, because God is not a finite, computable type being, which is what time is. It's a computation of motion. I'll talk about that in a second. And God isn't that. And so while I don't quite have, as it were, a positive comprehension of what eternity is, I know why I have to confess it. Not because I get it, but because I know I must adore him. Okay, and that this is the only way of preserving that adoration, or one of the only ways of preserving that adoration. All right, on to Boethius then, early 6th century Christian theologian and philosopher who gives us what becomes sort of the standard definition, at least in the Christian West, of this doctrine of eternity. Boethius describes God's eternity as, quote, "the whole simultaneous and perfect possession of boundless life." There's a lot in that, but it is to say that God's life is not, as it were, parceled out to him by bits and pieces. God's life is not ever so slightly coming into his possession and then flowing out of it into the past. God doesn't have a history behind him. God does not have a future in front of him. God does not have a life which is not currently and always and eternally fully actually his life. Not a life through which he is passing, a life that he is. God, in fact, technically, if we want to go with this, God doesn't have life. God, say, yeah, you know, Holly, right. God is life. God's life is not something fortuitous to him that he is experiencing, passing through, as it were. God, rather, is the life by which he lives. Okay, God is life. He can give life because he is life itself. One other, just a quick exposition of this. The Reformed theologian Francis Turretin, who was in the city of Geneva a little more than a century after John Calvin was, says this, and you can hear the echoes of Boethius. By the way, Boethius just echoes right down through the medieval theologians and straight into the Protestant tradition as well. And so Turretin, a Protestant theologian, a Reformed theologian, says, "True eternity has been defined by the scholastics." These are the medieval scholastics, are just the medieval theologians of the schools, okay? Thomas Aquinas and others like that, "to be the interminable possession of life, complete, perfect, and at once." Okay? "Thus, it excludes succession, no less than end, and ought to be conceived as a standing, but not a flowing now." God's now is not a now that stands sandwiched between God's past and God's future. Okay, your now, well, it's gone now, but do you know what I'm saying? Your now is this transient little moment that flits between innumerable before and afters that are coming and going. Okay, God's life is not a fleeting, is not a flowing now, but a standing now, he says. "The reason is because nothing flows away with time from the life of God as from ours. God has every moment at once whatever we have dividedly by succession of time. Hence, philosophers have well said that neither the future nor the past, he will be or was, but only the present, he is, can be properly applied to him. For the eternal duration of God embraces indeed all time, the past, present, and future. But nothing in him can be past or future because his life remains always the same and immutable." Gerhardus Voss, early 20th century biblical theologian, one of the good guys who was teaching at Princeton Seminary, in the early part of the century, defines eternity as that attribute of God whereby he is exalted above all limitations of time and succession of time, and in a single indivisible present possesses the content of his life perfectly, and as such is the cause of time. All right, I'll come back to that later. So, God is not measured by time. It is not a computational scale by which we, as it were, calculate the being and the life of God. God's life is not calculable, okay? It's not something that can be subjected to an instrument of measure, which time is. This is, by the way, what Boethius means when he says it's the perfect possession of boundless life. Boundless life can't be metricated. Boundless life can't be, as it were, parceled out and counted up, right? We'll get into the words of Elihu, again, one of my favorite doctrine of God theologians from all the Bible. Elihu, at the end of Job, just has a plethora of great things to say about this. We'll get to his statement in a few moments. Louis Burkhoff defines the doctrine as, or the eternity as that perfection of God whereby he is elevated above all temporal limits and succession of moments and possesses the whole of his existence in one indivisible present. Again, right into the 20th century, Boethius is still sort of kicking around in our theological language. Back a few centuries to the 17th, Dutch theologian Wilhelmus Abrakel. If you don't know, this is a quick aside, and I don't get commission on this, but if you don't know the work of Wilhelmus Abrakel, and you want to just own and dip into one of the classics of Reformed devotional but also scholarly literature, somehow wonderfully blended together in the same big long treatise, Wilhelmus Abrakel, The Christian's Reasonable Service. I even think I got a sale flyer for it the other day. So if you dig around online, you might even find it on sale. He defines eternity, and he puts it together with simplicity and immutability. These are things we've talked about in the past. I'll try to refresh you as we go. He says this: God's being is eternity, and eternity is God's being. It is not fortuitous as time is in relation to the creature. There can be no chronology within the being of God since his being is simple and immutable. Okay, what he means by this. We live in time. What Abrakel is saying is, technically speaking, though, God doesn't live in eternity. That is to say, we live in time because time is a measurement that in a certain sense dominates us, rules over us. When we say that we live in time, what we really mean is we live in such a way as we are subject to change. I'll explain why we connect those in a second. But God doesn't. Eternity is not a container inside of which God lives. Okay? Rather, eternity is just a way of saying that he is infinitely full of his own being. That is to say, his being isn't coming to him and slipping away from him. Rather, he is his own being, an absolute boundlessness, back to Boethius's word. An unbounded life is a life that cannot be subject to measure, because measure presupposes time. But think measure now more generically. Measure presupposes boundary, right? You can't measure something that doesn't have a boundary, whether that is temporal, whether that is spatial, okay? Something that doesn't have, or just in a pure metaphysical way, if we were talking about some immaterial entity, something that doesn't have limits to its being can't have a measure, okay? But time is a measure. Okay, so if God is infinite in being and boundless in his life, then there can be no measuring or computing of his life, because you can only compute and measure that of which there is a boundary to be found, right? But there's no boundary in God. There's no this much and thus no more, okay? There's no last thing, as we've said so many times here, about God. There's no bottom, as it were, to his glory, okay? There's no measuring. Why is God unfathomable? We went through this whole thing some time back where you know, to fathom, you drop a line in the water and you measure the fathoms when you find the bottom, okay? But you can't fathom God because there is no bottom. There is no last great thing way down there that you can drop a line on. think that's a dangling proposition, but it, you know, I think it makes its point. You can't drop a line on that which there is no edge, no bottom, no boundary. If God's life is boundless, then of course it's timeless in that sense. Brockel then is saying that God's eternity is not fortuitous to him as time is to us. In other words, time is something that in a certain sense forces itself upon you, happens to you, shapes you, directs you, frustrates you, measures you. Well, let's just say that. Whereas God does not relate to his eternity this way. His eternity is not something in which he lives. It is what he is. When we say that you are temporal and God's eternal, we don't quite mean it the same way. We mean that you have a relationship to time. We don't mean that God has a relationship to eternity. We mean strictly that God is eternity. He is the eternity by which he is eternal. So he says there can be no chronology within the being of God, since his being is simple and immutable. I'll explain, just if you can, tuck that away, and I'll unpack it before we're done today. But let me, since I don't see a, all right, make sure I actually do. So I have to measure the time, because I and you are not unbounded, nor is our time for Sunday school unbounded, so trying to put it in the boundaries. We'll get there. Herman Bovink says that there are three marks of the concept of eternity, three things that it doesn't have. It excludes a beginning and end and a succession of moments. I'm going to illustrate this for you in a second, and then we'll come back to it. First, then, quickly, if I dare, I brought in a Catholic. I might as well just bring in a pagan now too, and mention Aristotle just briefly. Throughout the Christian tradition, Aristotle's conception of time was generally accepted as a true description of time. I'll just admit, personally, I don't think that we have actually improved on our understanding. Now, we've understood relativity of how the measuring of time's passage is felt by entities given motion, space, all these sorts of things. Think Einstein and everything since then. But in terms of the strict definition, I think we still do find by Aristotle's description, he says that time is the number of movement in respect of the before and after. Time is the number of movement in respect of the before and after. Back to Bobbing's statement. It excludes a beginning, an end, and a succession of moments. Let me show you what I mean by this. And I'm going to use a different color for this. Maybe the green, since I'm making a slightly different point here. Let's call this state of being one. Okay, and let's call this state of being two. Okay, this is our beginning. Okay, this is our end. Okay, this is our point of departure. This is our point of arrival. Okay, and this is the measure of motion between these two, and that's what we call time. Time is the measure of motion between a beginning and an end. Okay. Now, this presupposes that the beginning and the end are not identical with each other, that there's something different about them. We're going into this today, so I'll give you the tech. There is no, as Aquinas would say, no terminus a quo, that is to say, no term from which, no point of departure, and no in a timeless being, and no terminus ad quem, that is to say, point of arrival or point to or term to which. So you go down, you go to Newark Airport and you board a plane, and you board your plane in a building called what? The terminal. Why is it called the terminal? Which is from the Latin terminus, which means simply means end, right? Now, when you board in the terminal to go somewhere, which end of your trip is it? Okay, it's your departure, your point from which, your terminus a quo. Okay, the point from which you are departing. When you arrive, let's say you're flying to LAX, you arrive in LAX, you deplane into a arrival, which is also called a terminal. This is the terminal at which you arrive, that is to say, your terminus ad quem, the term to which you are going, okay? So you have two ends now. You have a front end, you have a back end, you have a beginning end, you have a last end, as it were, or a destination. Time is the measure of motion between really distinct states of between two really distinct termini. Okay? Now, spatially, you get that. To get out there, let me think. About 6 hours with those headwinds going west, and about 5 hours or so coming back, right? Because you get those tailwinds. But whatever. Time is the measurement of the motion between one state from which and another state to which, call those ends, you are moving. So something that is timeless excludes three things, according to Bovink. It excludes a point of departure, it excludes a point of arrival, and then, of course, necessarily, it excludes a measure of motion between the points, right? In other words, to throw it in terms of a different doctrine, if something doesn't change, there can be no time for that thing. Because time requires movement from one really distinct terminus to another really distinct terminus. It requires movement, motion. Now, this doesn't have to be physical motion. We can say, you know, I can move from the lectern here to this pillar over here, and that's my terminus from which I left. This is the terminus at which I arrive, and you could clock the time in between. That's the counting of the motion. That's what Aristotle would say you were doing. You are counting the duration of motion between the really distinct states. Okay, a timeless being has no beginning, point of departure, has no end, point of arrival, which is not identical with its beginning, because God is the beginning and the end. He is the Alpha and the Omega. Because He's Alpha and Omega, there can be no time in God because there can be no movement in God. Now, coming out a little, this is a little kind of, we're having, to call Him eternal and really understand what it means, we are going to have some understanding of what time means. In other words, in order to appreciate why this is so different and unique for God to be eternal in this way. And maybe next week we'll talk about why are some things that are really obviously created and changeable also called eternal, like mountains and hills and human life, actually, when we receive Christ. We'll get into that. We have to lay some groundwork here first. And I think actually you're all used to this. How do we keep time in our lives? Okay, you have a watch, okay? But what is your watch? I mean, I have one up here too. What is your watch? Your watch is 12, well, if you have a, you know, the hands on your watch. Your watch is really a way of artificially carving up 24 hours, okay? And 24 hours are, of course, in other words, what is the 24 hours are a counting of something. Namely what?
Day and night.
Day and night. But exactly what does 24 hour, what motion takes place in the 24 hours? Yeah, the Earth's turn on its axis, one turn on its axis. So axial motion, okay? Movement from one state to another. From one state, 24 hours later, you arrive at another. Now you are one turn further along in our history, okay? So that we are, and the fact that it's 24, I mean, why isn't it tens? You know what I mean? Why isn't it like 20 or 30 hours? Why does an hour have to be 60? You know what I mean? In other words, why not carve it up into tens? 24? I don't know. It's an artificial counting system that we have laid on top of a motion that we're all experiencing, namely one axial rotation of our Earth. And then in addition to the, and then we have clocks, all these clocks and watches and everything are just are artificial numeric systems by which we, in a certain sense, carve up and measure into little increments and successions the movement that we're measuring. Then we have another motion also that we measure, but which also kind of helps us situate time. Our 24-hour days measure one motion, but then there's another sort of timekeeper that we all abide by.
Our
Calendar, right. And so on. A calendar isn't met. A calendar, while it's broken up into 365 increments indicating 365 and sometimes 366 axial rotations of the Earth, is actually one calendar. January 1st to December 31st measures a different motion, actually. All right, not axial motion, but it's an O. Orbital. Okay, and so what we've done is we've taken our axial measure and we have distributed it evenly into our orbital measure, and we've put those things together and we have days and years. Okay, and then with our clocks and watches, we have artificially carved down into 24 more basic units the days, and then we've carved those into 60 more basic units the minutes, and we carve those into 60 more basic units the seconds, and then I'll stop there, but you know, it goes on down. What are we doing? Every time we do this, we're measuring motion. Okay, we're measuring change. Now, we can call this solar time, and we measure our lives by solar time because on our Earth and on our solar system, that is sort of the fixed point by which we can understand, by which we carve up our passage of time. Okay, we're measuring motion, and then we are sort of then measuring the motion of our lives and then referring to the measure of motion in our lives by that measure of motion. So let us say that I believed something 5 years ago, but I changed my mind. Well, the fact that it was 5 years ago is just me taking that measurement of motion relative to the world in which I live and applying it to a motion that doesn't have anything to do with the sun at all, the fact that I changed my mind. That's a motion too, by the way. Are we good on that? So that if you change your mind, that's movement. Maybe not physical movement. It can't, you know, you can't, it's not an object hurling through space, but nevertheless, it is a movement in the sense of state of being one, in which you thought A, gives way to state of being B, in which you think B, okay, in which you think something else. Then time would in fact obtain. Like we can just be, I'll be very quick on this thought experiment. If we didn't have the sun, and if we didn't have axial motion, would we still have time? I would say yes, we would. It just would be much harder to uniformly apply it and arrange ourselves by it. The fact that someone in India is measuring days and years in the exact same way that you are, because we have this common motion that we're all experiencing, makes it easy for us to coordinate our times. If every person had a different sort of center point in terms of what they measured, a different kind of motion that they were measuring, then it would be very hard to have a universal clock by which we could all sort of, you know, make the phone call at the right time and do the Skyping at the right time and make sure it all coordinated. But nevertheless, you would still have time. Maybe not solar time, but you would still have before and after moments subject to a measure of motion between those moments. Okay? If there was anywhere, let's say it briefly, anywhere you have change, you have time, because time is the measure of motion between states of being, and if there aren't really, change is always a movement from one state of being to another. That's what change is. Every time, anywhere, whenever it ever happens, that's what change is. A change from one state of being to another, in which case it is a measurable state of being subject to counting up, okay, and it's temporal. All right, good. So much for that. Into the biblical basis, let me jump into a few texts. And let's go right back to Psalm 90, where we began with Moses' words. And Moses is making this point. By the way, just quickly, I think sometimes it's easy for us to gratuitously assume, hey, I understand what time is. I understand that you know, God's eternal, therefore it must mean that God's timeless. I think that's right, but in order to connect that, in order to really make that stand up and sort of answer the questions that are put to it, I think we'll have to bring in a few other considerations. Nevertheless, I want to look at a few of these texts and sort of explain to you how we might read them or understand them. First, Psalm 90, Moses begins, "You have been our dwelling place in all generations." So the point is this: you are our rock, you're our hiding place, you're our security, and not just for a while. That's his point. You're not just occasionally a good source of refuge. You are our dwelling place to all generations. Lord, you are sure. You are our confidence. And then he gets into this thing in verse 2 about God's identity, God's being God. And this is where we get into the from everlasting to everlasting. He says, before the mountains were born or you gave birth to the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Let me explain briefly what I think he's doing here. I think he's making the point that God's godness, God's being the God that he is, who, by the way, is the dwelling place for God's people in all generations, God's being a good dwelling place, which is to say God's being God, because that's what you're entrusting yourself to when you dwell in God. You're entrusting yourself to him and his godness. God's godness is not a temporary habitation for us. It's not a changing habitation. Why do we know? How do we know that? Because God doesn't derive any feature of his godness from things that are made. That is to say, from time. God didn't become a great dwelling place, not as as God. He may have become that for you and your experience and communion with him, but in himself, God didn't suddenly become something better off than he was, in which now he's a good source of habitation for you. Okay, God doesn't derive any feature of his godness from that which is not God. I think that's the main theological undercurrent in verse 2. So when he says, bear with me for a second. Before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world, and then he says, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. His point is, you did not become the sure source of habitation for us that you now are through some experience you had of your creation. You are God. This is the point, if I could just say it briefly. You are God even without creation. If there were no creation, you wouldn't be less than you are. God didn't become good for you because creation somehow made him good for you. Now, that's the point. Now, when he says, before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world, I'm taking world here as just the maximal state of created affairs. I don't think that we should understand, and I'll maybe get into this more next week, we should understand the psalmist as saying, strictly speaking, that there's a chronological moment that precedes the first moment of time. I think he's speaking in very ordinary, customary language about before the world. Now, I'll make my strange argument next week that technically speaking, there is no before the world in a chronological or temporal sense, because then time would precede creation, and then you'd have a big problem. Because then you'd have to say either time is God or time is something that conditions God that is not God from all eternity. And then watch the whole theological, the whole theology of God is just going to begin to collapse if you do that, okay? And traditionally Christians haven't done that. So when it says before the mountains were born, his point is not chronologically antecedent to this order of things. His point is independent of this order of things, you possess your fullness as God. Now, quickly on this statement, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. I actually think that this is a bit of poetic absurdity meant to elevate your view of God's godness. Okay? In other words, allow him to be a little bit strange in expressing himself so that we can understand God's beyondness here. And what he means is this. He says, from and to, right? From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Is it possible to move away from everlastingness? Can everlasting, in other words, to get back to this, can everlastingness be a beginning point from which you depart?
No.
Okay. Can everlastingness then be an arrival point at which you arrive previously not having been there, so to speak? No. And I think this is the point. When he says from everlasting to everlasting, you are God, I don't think he means from some past and into some future, because he chooses this term everlasting, which is to say, I just take it maybe naively, that everlasting can't have an expiration date on it. Right? If it did, it would then not be everlasting. So everlasting cannot be a terminus a quo. That is to say, I don't think that Moses is saying, you were everlasting and you left that behind and now you've become a new everlasting. He's not saying something like this happened. When he says from everlasting to everlasting, he doesn't mean that we should reduce it to some schema like this. Okay? I think it is simply, it's actually an absurdity. And I think it's intended to be an absurdity to show us that God simply exists beyond our way of counting and measuring things. Does that make sense? In other words, I think it's a It's a kind of holy or sanctified strangeness of language, meant to simply locate our conception of God beyond our conception of other things. Job 36. I promised some Elihu before we finish, so I'll make good on that. I've said in the past, I won't rehearse it at length. I think that Elihu at the end of the book of Job is in fact not one of the three friends that is later condemned. In fact, of all the named persons in the book of Job, named non-divine persons in the book of Job, Elihu is the only one whose words are not condemned. Now, the only other human speakers we have in the whole book of Job whose words are not condemned by the book of Job are those guys that brought the reports at the beginning about his children and about his livestock being stolen, his children being... Other than those very minor characters, every single other human speaker, including Job himself, in the book of Job is explicitly rebuked for what they say, except Elihu, the only one who is not. So with that being said, I think what we should do is we should read Elihu's words as the words, again, of the wisdom preacher who appears to give a kind of, if I can say it this way, maybe this is the wrong way to say it, a kind of warm-up speech for God's big speech that follows at the end of the book of Job. Elihu's warm-up speech is, in substance, almost identical to God's speech that follows it. Okay. Again, this is I take it that he's sort of the he's the prophetic forerunner of the word that's about to come from God. Job 37, he says this, and I'll start in verse 26. Remember that you exalt his work of which men have sung. All men have seen it. Man beholds from afar. I think this is the song, by the way, when he says, of which men have sung. Because this is in poetic form, perhaps this is a snippet of the song that they sung about his works. All men have seen it. I'm not going to sing it for you. Man beholds from afar. Behold, God is exalted. And I made this point a few weeks ago when we talked about incomprehensibility. And we do not know him. Okay? By the way, that's a good thing. God is exalted, and his exaltation is beyond the concepts in which you might imagine you capture him. Okay? The number of his years is unsearchable, he says. Why is the number of his years unsearchable? Because you can't count that high? Right? Maybe my son, Judah, might remember this when he was a kid. Like, do you remember when you were little? You might not. When you like tried to see how high you could count? Like you'd count to like 300, and you know it's been a long time. But and do you do that anymore? Nope. Why? Because it's a waste of time. Why? When would your counting end? It would never end, right? It's just because it would go on and on. And the point, when it says that his years are unsearchable, it's not that we don't have simply the time to count those up. It's more than that. It's because, well, actually, they're unsearchable because there is no number to them. There is no measure to them. In fact, it's this type of language that that the psalmist uses in Psalm 147, verse 5, when it says, great is our Lord and abundant in strength, and his understanding is infinite. Literally, it says his understanding is innumerable, not the kind of thing subject to enumeration. I think that's exactly Elihu's point here. When it says the number of his years is unsearchable, it's not that it's a math beyond what we currently are able to compute. It's that it's not computable. It's not something that is subject to a measure of computation, that you could put a definite in other words, it is not, God's glory and God's life is not a quantifiable sort of thing, okay, to which measurements of years and all this even make sense. In fact, I think he's just being accommodating. When he says the number of his years is unsearchable, it's unsearchable because technically there is no number of his years. There is no discrete quantity of time in which God has lived, as it were. A few other texts that run this down, you can note them in your mind. Isaiah 41:4, God is the Alpha and the Omega. My point with this is, if God is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning, Isaiah 41:4 doesn't say Alpha and Omega, it says beginning and the end. But the point is, if God is the beginning and the end, and if God is the Alpha and Omega, then God can't exist in this sort of way where he's moving from one state of being to another, because then God would be acquiring actuality that he did not have. In which case, he wouldn't be the beginning and the end. He would be a beginning moving towards some end not already possessed, right? But God doesn't have a beginning on his way to some future. God is the totality of all that he is, or we might say will be, already from eternity in and of himself. John 8, this is an interesting statement of Jesus, where Jesus gets into this whole discussion about time with some of his critics. And I may just take this as a last text and then pick up with some of these texts first thing next week. Jesus is in a bit of a back and forth at the end of John 8. And let me go back up to verse 51. Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." Now, the Jews are offended at this because that's like saying you have a power greater than the power of the patriarchs, especially Abraham, because Abraham died. And you're saying that you're here to give us something better that even Abraham experienced? It says, and the Jews answered in verse 52, we know that you have a demon. Abraham died and the prophets also. In other words, if you're here to say that if anyone keeps your word, they'll never see death, the greater prophets than you, surely, Abraham, the first who was of the elect and whose children we are, and all the prophets, all of these died, and you say, and they're incredulous, you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death? They're offended. Wait a minute. The people a lot better than you, Jesus of Nazareth, came and died, and you're saying you offer something better than what they had? Surely you are not greater than our father Abraham, who died. The prophets died too. Whom then do you make yourself out to be? In other words, listen, given time, everybody succumbs and to death. And here you are saying that you're going to free us from that. Jesus answered, "If I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. It is my Father who glorifies me, of whom you say, 'He is our God.' And you have not come to know me, nor to know him, but I know him. And if I say I do not know him, I'll be a liar like you, but I do know him and keep his word." And then he picks up where they attacked him. So you want to talk about Abraham? You brought up Abraham? Let's talk about Abraham for a second. "Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad." Now listen to their response. The Jews said to him, "You are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham?" The irony of they're mocking him, right? Because if he were 50 years old, about 20 years older than he was at the time of speaking these words, would that have possibly made it remotely possible that he saw Abraham? See, Abraham's been dead for about close to 2,000 years at this point. Adding 20 years, this is the irony, adding 20 years to his life would be, it's a mockery. You're not even 50, right? Because you would need to be, 1,950 years older than that even to have seen Abraham. And have you seen Abraham? It's a joke. How old are you? Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born," and he doesn't say "I was," he could say that. There's certainly the being verb could certainly be past tense, right? It's not what he says, though. He says, "Before Abraham was," not "I was," "I am." In other words, if you knew who I am, and if you knew who spoke to you, and if you know who is the one who promises life from death, if you knew the one who has the power over life and death, if you knew the power of life that I have in me to give to others, John 5, right? The Father has life in himself and has given to the Son to have life in himself to give it to whomever he pleases. If you understood who I am or what kind of life I really possessed, then you would understand that Abraham saw my day and was glad before Abraham was. Not "I was," "I am." That's the kind of life I have to give. I have a quality of life and a power to give life that exceeds your computational measures, whether that's 20 years or 2,000 years. That's indifferent to me. I don't actually have life so finite and fleeting as that. And they picked up stones to throw at him, and he hid himself and went out of the temple. Let's leave it there, and next week we'll pick up and look at a few more texts, a couple more explicit with regard to timelessness, and then get into, and then maybe the last half of next week, we'll get into some of these disputes about why are there some who are saying we need to now think of God's eternality as really nothing but an endless succession of before and after moments. I want to suggest that that, in fact, is not going to be adequate, not simply because of the verses that talk about eternity, but because of a host of other doctrines as well. We'll bring some of that in and consider it, too. Let's pray.